Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, July 24th, 2026, we're delighted to host a discussion on parental rights from the founding to the present day. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm Director of Networks here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. A couple of housekeeping notes before we get to introductions and to discussion beyond. First, a reminder for any attendees that are seeking a CLE credit. We'll be posting a CLE code in the chat box at some point during the presentation today. Two things should occur at or around the time that code is posted. First, you should hear an audible ding. And second, a slide will be posted on screen noting that the CLE code has been posted in the chat box. Please write this code down when it appears because we'll be required to provide it during your attendance reporting form at the end of the webinar. Additionally, written materials for this event have been emailed to all registrants prior to the webinar, and that link will also be dropped in the chat box shortly. Lastly, we are hoping to have time in today's program for audience questions. If you have questions throughout the program, please submit them via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. Okay, housekeeping out of the way, we can turn to our panel. I'm glad to say we've got a fabulous panel with us today. However, with a lot to discuss, at the risk of giving our speakers short shrift, we will give short bios and then be able to get into the discussion. If you'd like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. I'll go ahead and introduce our moderator, and then he will introduce our panel. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Gene Scher, who's a partner at Scher Jaffe LLP. His wide array of experience in areas ranging from defamation to higher education law, product liability warranty, statutory interpretation, and tax. Beyond his practice, he also teaches courses in Supreme Court litigation, Blitz Freedom litigation, and advanced litigation skills as an adjunct professor of law at Brigham Young University Law School. With that, I can hand it over. I'll go ahead and get off your screens. Thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Scher, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you. And thanks to all of you who are joining us, and especially to our panelists who are here to talk to us about parental rights from the founding to the present day. And this is part of the Federalist Society's celebration of the 250th anniversary of America. And I'm going to introduce each panelist as they, just before they begin their presentation. So our first short presentation is going to be from Professor Melissa Mascella, who's a professor of the practice philosophy, professor of the practice in philosophy at the University of Notre Dame's McGrath Institute for Church Life. She's done a lot of work in ethics, political philosophy, as well as law, done a lot of research and writing about the family. So Professor Mascella, why don't we start with you?
Great. So thank you so much, Gene, and thanks to everybody at the Federalist Society for helping to put this panel together. I'm really looking forward to the whole discussion. What I want to talk about very briefly is the history of respect for parental rights in our nation's legal tradition. And based on my research, it seems clear that there is a deeply rooted understanding in our nation's legal tradition that parents have natural authority over their children that is prior to and independent of the state's authority. This is evident, for instance, in writings of influential common law jurists like Blackstone and Kent. Blackstone, for instance, presented parental duties and the corresponding authority that parents have to fulfill those duties as natural, writing that these duties are, quote, laid on them not only by nature herself, but by their own proper act in bringing the children into the world, unquote. And you get similar statements from Kent and other common law jurists. Now, this understanding is reflected in cases throughout the 19th century, in which courts typically apply the standard that is well described by Joseph Story, according to which state interference with parental rights regarding the custody and care of their children could only be justified by proof of, quote, gross ill-treatment on the part of the parent. And as Judge Thornton, who notably was a member of the 39th Congress that passed the 14th Amendment, wrote in an 1870 case, quote, the parent has the natural right to the care and custody of his child, and this right should not be abridged by the state, except from a necessity arising from gross misconduct or almost total unfitness on the part of the parent, unquote. So again, you see the bar here is very high for state intervention. Now, more generally, in the early Republic and under the common law tradition, minors' relation to the state at common law was typically mediated through the authority of parents. So for example, minors generally could not and still can't make binding contracts for themselves. They couldn't sue for themselves. They couldn't enlist in the military without parental consent. And if they did, they could be returned home on writs of habeas corpus issued at their parents' request. Now, the state does have some role, obviously, in ensuring that children are properly cared for within our tradition, but that role has always been seen as subsidiary to that of parents, meaning that it's aimed at ensuring that parents fulfill their own duties, the parents' own duties, to maintain, protect, and educate their children. And then in some cases, for instance, through free common schooling, to assist parents in the fulfillment of those duties, but all without usurping their prior authority over their children. And we see some examples of this. I don't have time to get into details, but we see examples of this in the educational context in a series of late 19th and early 20th century state cases in which parents sought to avail themselves of the benefit of free public schools, but wanted to opt their children out of particular classes. There were 8 such cases, and parents won 7 out of the 8, largely on the basis of the common law understanding of parental authority over children as prior to the state's authority. And these cases also notably subject state action to a very rigorous level of scrutiny that mirrors today's strict scrutiny standard. And so I think they can also arguably provide historical warrant for the application of strict scrutiny in parental rights cases today. Now, this is all relevant to today more broadly because the Supreme Court has indicated that unenumerated rights ought to be identified and defined in light of our nation's history and tradition. And that history indicates that parental rights were clearly recognized and broadly protected under common law with a very high bar for justifying state interference. This is also important for properly interpreting the scope and strength of parental rights under Pierce and Meyer, because in my view, what these cases did was effectively declare that parental rights as understood in common law were constitutionally protected under the 14th Amendment. Now, these cases relied on due process, but I think, you know, you could also use this historical understanding to anchor parental rights in the Privileges or Immunities Clause or perhaps the 9th Amendment. But however we anchor the parental rights constitutionally, I do think it's important that we don't just limit parental rights to a subset of free exercise rights, which is what has happened recently. It happened in Yoder. It happened more recently in Mahmood. And I think those were good cases, but I think it's also important to protect the rights of all parents, including non-religious ones. So I was very happy to see that in the recent Mirabelli decision, the Supreme Court did talk about parental rights independent of free exercise rights. So I think that that bodes well for the future.
Well, thank you, Professor. Our next speaker will be Professor Marty Guggenheim, who is a professor of clinical law emeritus at New York University School of Law, where he's taught for many years. And Professor, I'm not sure whether you are still directing the Family Defense Clinic or whether that was one of your past roles, but he's spent many years litigating parental rights and family rights cases, so he has a deep understanding of the law in this area, as well as some philosophical perspectives that he's going to share with us now.
Thank you, Gene, and it's a pleasure to be here, a privilege to be here, and I enjoy particularly following Melissa's remarks, which I'll support from a slightly different perspective, which is that the founding principles of the United States from 1789 demand the conclusion that parental rights are fundamental. They're fundamental to our very existence as a nation, because the founding principles really have as their first principles three characteristics that all lead to the same conclusion about parental rights. The first is that we are a democracy, and that the people choose the government, and the government is of the people. And in such a regime, you must privatize child rearing, value inculcation. If the government played a disproportionate role in inculcating future voters with values, we would be corrupting the founding principle of our country, that the government doesn't tell the people tells the government. So by necessity, the government has to play a de minimis role in value inculcation. It doesn't mean zero, but it certainly means diminished and significantly smaller than the alternative. So what is the alternative? Well, infants are born, and somebody's got to teach them. And if the government may not, then we have by default what's left. But the second characteristic of our founding principles is we are a religious people. We have in the First Amendment, not by accident, two pillars of concept that all lead to parental rights. We have freedom of speech, and we have freedom of, which is freedom of thought and expression, and we have freedom of religion. Now, how can I baptize an infant if parents don't have that authority? We give to our children our values because the Constitution sets it up for that purpose. So the twin pillars of freedom of speech, maximizing the marketplace of ideas, letting the best view prevail, central to a democracy, combined with a deep commitment to religious freedom, to diversity, necessitates the conclusion that we privatize child rearing, that the government has to be hamstrung in interfering with that value inculcation system, lest we become the opposite of a democracy. So others today will talk about the Supreme Court and case law and doctrine and whether we can ground it in the Privileges and Immunities Clause or whether it's substantive due process, which I know some in this room aren't happy to celebrate. I don't care about any of that. My contribution to this conversation is the most fundamental building block of American principles is parental rights. I'll stop there for now, Gene.
Well, thank you, Professor. Our next speaker is Dr. Michael P. Ferris, who's a longtime litigator in the parental rights area and is currently the general counsel of the National Religious Broadcasters. But Mike, for many years, and I think, Mike, you may have founded the Homeschool Legal Defense Fund, right?
That's right.
Founder and general counsel and anyway, ran that organization. And then he also spent a few years as the CEO of Alliance Defending Freedom, an organization that also does a lot of litigation in the parental rights space. And he's going to share some more granular thoughts, I think, about how can we properly ground parental rights in the Constitution.
Well, thank you, Gene. And I have the privilege of being able to say that my friends Melissa and Marty Guggenheim have said things that I want to wholeheartedly endorse. Both of their comments, I think they're well said, that kind of no matter which angle you come from, we should get to the conclusion that parental rights are of the highest value and should be protected with great vigor by our legal and political system. I would just say a couple of words about the current situation, including the Mahmoud and Mirabelli case. I litigated perhaps one of the most infamous losses in the parental rights sphere, and that was the case of Moser versus Hawkins County School District that was decided in the 1980s and by the Sixth Circuit and cert denied by the Supreme Court. And that was the first case that really went the wrong direction broadly on the ability of parents to opt their children out of objectionable material in the public schools. Up until then, opting out was reasonably predictable that you could do. But after that case, we hit an extended season with about 40 years. Where the court has gone in the wrong, courts generally, not the Supreme Court, the courts generally have gone in the wrong direction and given great ability of the government to say that your kids are captives to whatever the public school wants to offer them. That has been dramatically changed by the Mahmoud case. And I view it as a direct reversal, although by implication of the Moser case that I had litigated. So I felt quite vindicated, frankly, by the issuance of that decision, which, of course, I wrote an amicus brief in that case and talked about Moser in my amicus brief. And I agree strongly with what Melissa said of the importance of grounding parental rights, not merely in the Free Exercise Clause, but in parental rights generally. I argued twin cases in the Michigan Supreme Court years ago for homeschoolers. A religious family, we won 4-3 under the compelling interest test. And the following case, 30 minutes later, I lost 4-3 on parents' rights for a secular family. Now, the good news is that the homeschooling movement, both Christian and secular, got the Michigan legislature to fix that after that decision so that both secular and religious families had the right to homeschool. But that was, to me, a complete anomaly. It should not have mattered whether you're religious or not religious. All parental rights for education should have been protected. The Mahmoud case in particular has breathed some life into the Smith doctrine in the area of parental rights, at least. Smith is still causing problems in other areas of religious freedom, but in this zone, I would say that it's been corrected pretty well. I would just briefly want to talk about a law review article, and I encourage people to look it up if they'd like. I wrote on parental rights. It's called Rethinking the Basis for Parental Rights, and it's at 18 Liberty University Law Review at page 554. I wrote it in 2024. And I basically argue that we should look at procedural due process rather than substantive due process. Not believing that I'm not a person that thinks there's anything inherently wrong with substantive due process done correctly. But by positing an alternative theory, in case substantive due process fails us, where do we go? And so my argument is that procedural due process has been used by the Supreme Court in about half of their parental rights cases, including one that Marty Guggenheim won in, many years ago on getting the standard for parental rights to be the clear and convincing evidence standard, very important parental rights case. But about half the time they've used procedural due process, about half the time they've used substantive due process, like in Yoder and Meyer and Pierce. And if you break those cases down, what it comes down to is if they're taking away all of your parental rights, they use procedural due process. If they're taking away one element of your parental rights, like education or medical decision making, they use substantive due process. There's no rhyme or reason, nor is it ever explained why they do that. And my belief is that if we use procedural due process at all times, it would require clear and convincing evidence that the parent has abused the child, neglected the child, or abandoned the child, or the standard, the historical standard that Melissa recited. I'd be fine with that historical recitation of, you know, gross abuse or some high level of proof. But until the government proves through proper procedures that the parents have harmed their children in these specified ways, the government should have to leave parental decision-making alone, whether it's one element of decision-making or they're taking away all your ability to make decisions for your children by removing custody altogether. So that's my basic theory as a basically a backup alternative if substantive due process goes away.
Well, thank you, Mike. Our next and concluding speaker will be Anthony Sanders, who's the director of the Center for Judicial Engagement at the Institute for Justice, where he's also a senior attorney. And he litigates cases on a number of different topics there as part of IJ. And he recently published a book called Baby Ninth Amendments, How Americans Embraced Unenumerated Rights and Why It Matters. And he's going to be talking to us about how parental rights can be and increasingly are protected under state constitutions. Anthony?
Well, thank you, Gene, and thank you to the Federalist Society for inviting me to this wonderful discussion and to all of my my co-panelists. So I'm going to just give a little bit of a brief outline on how state constitutions can protect parental rights and some of the history there, because although everyone knows about the U.S. Constitution and the protections it has for us in all kinds of ways, if you're talking about your state or local government, which in parental rights we usually are, then there's also our state constitution that we can draw upon. So we've had state constitutions since before there was the United States of America. They started being adopted by some states actually before the Declaration of Independence in 1776. And the first one that had a Declaration of Rights was Virginia. So speaking of the founding fathers, George Mason, who you should remember amongst the various founders, he drafted the Declaration of Rights. He did the first draft of that state's constitution and wrote some very influential language in Section 1 of that draft. And it protects, this language protects very broadly what he called inherent rights that can't be taken away by society. He said the enjoyment of life and liberty, right? That's pretty broad language. The means of acquiring and possessing property, pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety. This language was tinkered with, but it spread. And it, today you can find variants of it in about 2/3 of all state constitutions. Then flash forward a few years, we get the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and we get language in there that says the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people, which is, of course, the Ninth Amendment, which has never really been used in federal constitutional law, not very much. But that language inspired state constitutional writers to place similar language in their own constitutions, and a different set of two-thirds of all state constitutions today have that kind of language in their state bill of rights. So if you look to your own state bill or declaration of rights, you have very good chance that you have some variant of those provisions or other provisions that can be read to protect rights that are not explicitly in the Constitution. Now, notice this whole time, I have not mentioned the words due process. So most state constitutions also have a due process clause. Some do not, but instead have this alternative language. And so when we're discussing unenumerated rights, whether a right is protected by a state or federal constitution because it's impliedly in there, even though every jot and tittle of that right isn't explicitly stated, we need to remember it's not synonymous with what we usually call substantive due process. Substantive due process is a way that due process clauses can be read to protect substantive rights, not just procedural rights, like we just heard Michael discuss. But they can be protected, unenumerated rights, in all kinds of other ways in either the federal constitution, right? We heard about the Privileges or Immunities Clause or the Ninth Amendment, but also under state constitutions. And as I said, in the state courts, that's where a lot of the action is. And so we should keep these in mind. Now, this isn't just theoretical. This also happens in court. Most states over the last century or so have followed the Supreme Court's lead. In these cases, we heard about Meyer and Pierce, and also another case, Farrington, in using due process principles to protect parental rights. However, states have also played with their own state constitutions. And there's a number of examples I discuss in my book about Ninth Amendment language being used to protect parental rights. An example, a very recent example, is in recent years, some judges in Georgia and the appellate bench have pushed back about some overzealous use in the CPS system there. And Judge Stephen Dillard, who I know is a friend of the Federalist Society, he's had a series of opinions there where he said, you know, we should be holding the feet to the fire on these agencies and applying a strict scrutiny standard when it comes to parental rights. But we should be looking to beyond just due process clauses. And Georgia has its own version of the Ninth Amendment, and he's encouraged other judges to look to that language for a way to better textually hook, you might say, those unenumerated rights. There's also examples of this going far before Meyer and Pierce. As Melissa was saying, we have constitutional rulings by state courts going back into the 19th century on various parental rights issues. And there's an interesting case that I cite in my book from Iowa in 1869, which is not a parental rights case, but one of the judges is discussing unenumerated rights, how they're protected. And he says at one point about the state's version of the Ninth Amendment, the rights of property and rights arising under the domestic relations of husband and wife, parent and child, et cetera, may not be preserved by express constitutional provisions, yet they exist in all their perfection, and no legislative enactment impairing them can be sustained. This is over 50 years before the Supreme Court waded into this area. So you can see that parental rights have long been protected under state constitutions, understood to be protected, and in all kinds of ways beyond what we might call substantive due process. Whether you think that's a thing or not, there are many other avenues to protect this unenumerated right. Finally, I'll say Texas just recently amended its constitution to explicitly protect parental rights. It's actually in the Texas Bill of Rights now. And so states also have that avenue if you're able to amend your state constitution, which is much easier than the federal constitution, to protect parental rights.
Well, thank you, Anthony. Let me now ask each of our panelists, since you've heard a presentation from everyone, do any of you have any comments you would like to make about other presentations that we've heard thus far?
I mean, I would just be happy to piggyback on Marty's presentation. Of course, I agree with wholeheartedly with everything that he said, but also simply to add to that the whole idea of limited government, right? The idea of a government that doesn't extend into every sphere of life presupposes that there are some sort of spheres of authority or jurisdiction that are in principle kind of generally out of bounds for the government and that require some kind of extreme justification for the government to enter. And I think the most obvious of those spheres of authority is the natural sphere of authority of the family, which is a society that precedes government and would exist even without the government and would have that kind of natural authority and responsibility, even if there were no government. So I think that basic idea that there are these other authorities in society that the government has an obligation to respect, a kind of basic jurisdictional question about the nature of limited government, is also really important to consider as just at the heart of the very structure and founding ideals of our nation.
Well, thank you. Any other comments from our panelists about each other's presentations? Well, let me throw out a question for you, for all of you to consider, which gets back to our celebration of the 250th anniversary of the founding. What I'd like to ask each of you to consider is, how do we think the founders of our nation would have understood the protections in the federal Constitution, which I realize we're not quite to the 250th anniversary of that yet, but how do we think the founders would have understood those protections in the area of parental rights? And I guess we also have to assume that they would buy into the idea that the federal Constitution has been incorporated against the states, which I suspect many of them would find surprising as well. But assume incorporation, and maybe a way to ask the question more precisely is, you know, what if we could transport some of them to our, to the present and talk to them about the recent Mahmoud case? That's been mentioned by a couple of our panelists. That's the case in which the Supreme Court just last term, what was it, two terms ago now, anyway, just very recently held that religious parents have a right under the Free Exercise Clause of the Constitution to opt their children out of instructional materials at a public school, in this case, my county, Montgomery County, Maryland. But the court held that those parents had a right under the Free Exercise Clause to opt their children out of instructional materials that the parents found offensive to their faith in one respect or another. If we could assemble a group of founders, maybe some of those who had been part of the Constitutional Convention, and we were to ask them, well, do you think the Supreme Court properly interpreted the First Amendment in that case? How do we think they would react? Again, assuming incorporated.
Since I am closest in age, perhaps, to the Supreme Court, to the founders, rather, in some respects, as a great-grandfather, but I think that before they would get to the First Amendment, they would be shocked that any government would be engaged in the kind of activity that we're talking about. And the whole theory of limited government, in the First Amendment, there's a church autonomy doctrine that the church can rule itself. I think that's implicit whether there's a First Amendment or not. And I think that the same thing is true of the family autonomy doctrine, that the family gets to rule itself. There are jurisdictions of life. The government has its jurisdiction. The family has its jurisdiction. And the church has its jurisdiction and so on. And so I think that the idea that government would be even intruding. And so I hearken back to what Martin Guggenheim said about the heavy-handed nature of indoctrination. That case was, if anything was ever heavy-handed, that was heavy-handed. The instructions that were given to the teachers there were just way over the top. Of how to intervene and counterbalance what the parents had objected to, what the children objected to. And so, you know, he's right. It's impossible to do nothing, but it ought to be touch very lightly. And whether you're indoctrinating things I like or things I don't like, it still should be done, you know, only when you absolutely have to and very lightly, and not in intruding anyone's freedom of conscience, no matter where they enter the conscience point, whether it's you know, considered right, left, or Catholic, or Protestant, or Islamic, or whatever. It shouldn't matter. The same thing should come down at the end of the day in that regard. And so I think that they might be troubled about some of the technicalities of the incorporation doctrine and so on, but I think that they would very much support the ultimate outcome.
Okay. Good. Other, Marty, you're, go ahead.
Yeah, let me chime in here. The thought experiment's complicated, Gene, because the founders had no conception of mandatory education laws.
Right.
So they lived in a world where children were an afterthought, if they were even an afterthought. And a modern community has come to appreciate an idea that was beyond foreign to the founders, which is called children's rights. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm an odd duck in this panel because I don't eat lunch with Federalist Society lawyers every week. The folks I spend a lot of time with may not even join an event like this, but you guys are my firm allies in defending parental rights. However, there are a lot of very good people in this country that don't like my views because they would say I don't care enough about children. And so once we have a compulsory education law, and I'm a fervent supporter of one, and of Mike's keen efforts to permit an alternative method of delivering the education. But once we have a public school system, we can't avoid the question of, are public officials empowered to inculcate students with values? They must be, because you're teaching children to be kind and generous and not speak when others are. It's unavoidable. The hard question becomes, what's the end of it? Where does it stop? And we might all agree that in Mahmud, it was a call that was, some would say, exceedingly easy. And I might say, a closer call, but when we get to many other examples, we have to acknowledge the government is inculcating children with values, and it's unavoidable. And so in that world, some of what we've said doesn't answer the questions.
Okay. Go ahead, Melissa. You go ahead.
Yeah, I would just add to that I think the founders, many of the founders would be concerned even about the idea of compulsory education that is primarily state run. Now, they might not be concerned about a kind of compulsory education in general with a variety of providers of that education all on an equal footing. But, you know, the idea that the state would be considered the preferred or the default education provider, which is effectively the situation now under compulsory education, where for the most part, the only publicly funded way to have your children educated is to allow the state to educate them. Which I think in principle, in my view, kind of unduly gives preference to the state's preferred values and pedagogical methods and everything else over the preferred values, pedagogical methods and educational setting and so on that the parents might think is best for their children. So, I mean, I think many of the founders might be skeptical about that in general and worried about this preferencing of the state's educational authority and educational ideals over that of parents, which is effectively what's happened in the current system. I would also note that while I agree that compulsory education laws in general are justified, I don't think historically that the basis for those laws was primarily an awakening to the importance of children's rights. I mean, if you look back at the history of movements for the common schools and then for compulsory education, it was much more about wanting to ensure a homogeneous population, concerns about immigration, often, you know, very blatant anti-immigrant sentiment behind a lot of that.
Not to mention anti-Catholic. Sentiment.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. I mean, that was very clear, particularly in the Oregon law leading to the Pierce case. Right. And in, you know, at the Blaine amendments in many state constitutions around that time and so on. So the history of this is somewhat ugly, actually, right? Rather than being a kind of history about an enlightened view about the need to actually take into account the interests and well-being of children. And I also think, and I know Marty would agree with this, that both empirically and philosophically, if you were to design, the ideal system where children are most likely to have their rights protected, it would be the system in which parents, who are the ones closest to the children, most naturally motivated to want the children's well-being, who have the closest alignment of interests with the children, who know the children better than anybody else in almost all circumstances, where the parents would be the ones who have the primary authority over the children to make those decisions on behalf of children. And that's also the rationale that's been articulated by the court. It's been articulated in the by the common law thinkers as well, right? That this is the idea that parental rights are opposed to children's rights, which you sometimes see in contemporary legal scholarship, I think is just completely false. I think that the opposite, in fact, is true, that the best protection for children's rights is the proper protection of parental rights.
To add to that, it's always hard to play this game of what would the founders think. So we of course have to tread carefully here. But I think with the assumptions that you gave us, Gene, what one kind of really good example in our history where I think the founders would be entirely on board, just about everyone would be on board, is how this dichotomy that Marty was talking about was laid out in Meyer versus Nebraska, where the court says, look, there are alternatives here. You could have a system like in Sparta, where the state educates everyone for this common goal of, strong army and installing certain values and taking people away from the family. And of course, that's in Plato's Republic. I think it's tongue in cheek, as Plato's putting it, but it's in there. But we don't do that. And yet there's a whole other side of things where you could have a total libertarian world where there is no state education, there's no compulsory whatever. You just have kind of minimal protections about if parents really aren't being good parents. And yet we're in the middle here where we're kind of muddling through, and there are ways to protect parents' rights and protect children's rights when we're muddling through that. One is what my colleagues and many of you have done over the years, which is try to protect alternatives to compulsory public education, such as school choice programs and homeschooling and that. Another is to have these protections for unenumerated rights when these issues come up in court. And so there's no exact easy answer. But if we're going to be in this world that the founders probably couldn't have envisioned, we need to have a way to balance this. And we can't have the balance to just be, well, the police power is so broad that the state can do what it wants because, you know, they're in for the best of us. That's not really the way the founders would have viewed government, as not the way we should either.
Okay.
I wanted to comment on the term children's rights for just a minute. Now, in certain contexts, it's absolutely the correct terminology and the best terminology. A child in the juvenile justice system clearly has rights. But when it comes to the family relationship, I think the common law would have been much more often using the terms the child has needs and the parent has responsibilities to meet those needs. The child has a need for food and clothing and education and medical care. And those are legally enforceable. When the parent neglects those needs, the state has the duty and the authority to come in to take action to see to it that the child's needs are met. And so when it's in a needs responsibilities framework, it reinforces the idea that the correct method of meeting these interests of the child is through the family. And the government only comes in cases of default. And whereas when you get into a rights construct, just the language of rights tends to involve the government at an earlier stage. And that's why I prefer the needs responsibilities framework rather than the rights framework.
Well, thank you for that. We now have, by my count, 20 now questions that have been posed by our viewers. I'm impressed that there are 20 people watching this webinar. So we've got about 12 minutes left. So why don't we go to some questions from our audience? And let me begin with one from our friend Roger Severino, who's asking a question about the Mirabelli case. And again, and that was a Supreme Court decision just this past term on the court's so-called emergency docket, which involved a request to reinstate a preliminary injunction that had been issued by a federal judge in California against a California law that essentially allows school officials to displace parents in deciding whether to try to transition a child to a gender opposite their birth sex, obviously a subject of great controversy in the country today. And the Supreme Court reinstated that preliminary injunction and said that injunction is going to stay in place while the case is appealed by the state there. So anyway, Roger's question is this: Mirabelli held that the right of parents to direct the upbringing of their children, quote, includes the right not to be shut out of participation in decisions regarding their children's mental health. And his question is, do you think this means the Supreme Court may revisit Jacobson versus Massachusetts, which affirmed compulsory vaccination with respect to mandatory vaccination of school kids? Marty, how would you answer that?
Let me take that. The answer is no. And it's no because Jacobson is a police power case. And Mirabelli is a parents patriae power case, and they're totally distinct state authorities. So Jacobson is establishes a principle that the state has a duty to protect others. This wasn't about the person. This wasn't Typhoid Mary who was being protected. This was us from her. And when we're talking about the modern cases of great interest, like at Mirabelli, we're talking about parents patriae. So whatever is the right answer there, which is a red-blue question, of course, Jacobson has nothing to say about it.
Okay. Any other panelists want to weigh in on that one?
I would get to the same result in a slightly different manner, but in the interest of time, I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. All right. Well, let me take up a question now from Kelly Shackelford, who asks, do you think the Supreme Court is avoiding addressing the basis of the rights of parents outside of the religious liberty context? What do the panelists think about that? Obviously, Mirabelli was the classic case where they, you know, they based their decision squarely on the free exercise clause. They didn't even talk about due process at all.
I could take that very briefly and then leave it to others. I would have said absolutely they are until Mirabelli came out, which was quite a surprise to many people. Of course, after Dobbs, the elephant in the room is what's left of substantive due process, including rights that conservatives might like, because often conservatives criticize substantive due process, like parental rights. And so it seems like we have an answer here from some of the conservative justices that, well, there maybe is something left to substantive due process when it comes to at least to parental rights. And it's not just in the religious context, because there's a part of Mirabelli that applies to the non-religious context for, outside of the First Amendment. So I think there is something. I think that's a really strong signal. There is something left. What I would say is that if you're going to do that and you're going to use the history and tradition rubric, there's all kinds of other rights out there that have a lot of history and tradition, like economic liberty, property rights, you know, name all kinds of other things that the founders were into. And so it's going to open the door to, hopefully, from where I come from, protecting those rights as well. I don't see how you can just let parental rights in the door and then slam the door shut on everything else.
Other responses to Kelly?
I could just add briefly that I think in Mahmood, the court, as it often does, wanted to decide the case at hand, and the case at hand did not require going beyond the use of free exercise, because the case at hand was litigated primarily on free exercise grounds, and the objections were religious, brought by religious parents. And so in that case, while I had hoped and, you know, asked the court in an amicus brief to kind of go beyond that and also address the independent parental rights question, because it was going to need to resolve that anyway, eventually, you know, they, as they often do, for prudential reasons, among others, resolved it more narrowly on free exercise grounds. But I think they're willing to go there. And I think Mirabelli is an indication that they are willing to go there when they need to, when the case requires the recognition of parental rights that are not rooted in free exercise or in a religious objection. So I think inevitably and probably quite soon, given the number of cases that are being presented to the Supreme Court that will require this, in addition to Mirabelli, but, you know, full merits briefing cases, I think eventually they will have to clarify the true scope and strength of parental rights under Pierce, whether they want to change the anchoring of that or simply say that this is a valid substantive due process right, given the clear history and tradition that underlies it. Either way, I think they will have to address that question soon.
If I could just add quickly, I think that Kelly's question implies that, you know, why has the court been denying cert in some of the cases that a lot of us would have liked to have seen it done in this area. And my read is that if there's any flaw whatsoever in the legal vehicle, that there's any question about the facts at all, any question about the standing or ripeness, they're simply not going to take the case right now. I think we need to tee up perfect parental rights cases, absolutely clean vehicles, and then I think the court will likely take one.
Well, let me just add a couple of points in response to Kelly's excellent question as well. I think the Mirabelli case is a bellwether in another respect as well, and that is that you may have noticed that Justice Barrett had a very interesting concurring opinion there, where somewhat surprisingly, given that she clerked for Justice Scalia, who is not a fan of substantive due process. But she writes in her concurring opinion in a way that suggests that she's very open to a substantive due process grounding for parental rights. or perhaps grounding parental rights in the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which, of course, you know, Justice Scalia rejected that as a basis for incorporating the Bill of Rights against the states. Justice Thomas has indicated that he thinks privileges and immunities rather than the Due Process Clause is the proper way to incorporate the Bill of Rights against the state. And Justice Barrett's concurrence in Mirabelli suggests that she's at least open to that pathway as well. The other little data point that I would add is a case that I'm personally involved in called International Partners for Ethical Care, in which the Supreme Court granted just about 3 weeks ago, and it's an important parental rights case, I think, not because the court's going to make a decision about the substantive basis for parental rights, but this is a case that involves a question of parental standing, and specifically, you know, how immediate does the concrete harm to parental rights have to be in order for parents who are subject to a law that's clearly designed to displace them as the primary decision makers with respect to their children, in this case, gender transitions, to what extent does the harm have to be immediate and concrete for parents to be able to challenge a law like that in federal court? And the court had previously denied cert in three or four cases like this, but they granted cert in our case just a few weeks ago, suggesting that they are at least that they are at least serious about deciding what exactly is the standard for standing in parental rights cases, which has the potential to open up a lot more cases that could be brought if they adopt a relatively friendly standard. Anything else in response to Kelly's question? Well, here's another question. This is probably going to be our last one from Stephen Gillis under Mahmood and potentially Mirabelli. What's the remedy if parents can show that the local public school education is pervasively hostile to their religious or conscientious values? And do you agree that there are such school systems, for example, in San Francisco? Any thoughts on that?
I have participated in litigation where we've pled that the correct remedy there is that the parents get their private education reimbursed. And so I don't know. I litigated one of the early school choice cases on whether or not the Establishment Clause and Free Exercise Clause, how do they work together in laws that ban religious participation. Won the Establishment Clause, lost the free exercise component of that case. And so it's an open question, but I think when it's a remedy in a case like this, I think it's clearly a valid remedy.
Other thoughts?
I agree. I think that's the only remedy for a case like that. And I would argue systemically that where public schools have become increasingly kind of ideological in their teaching. I think the only reasonable systemic remedy to that is a kind of overarching school choice policy that allows any parent to effectively use public funding to seek alternative educational vehicles for their children.
Well, thank you for those responses. And Kayla, we are right at the 1 o'clock mark. You're probably going to tell me we have to adjourn.
Unfortunately, yes. I hate to interrupt because I know it's been a fabulous discussion. Thank you all for joining us. We really appreciate you taking this section of your days and sharing your expertise and insight, especially on a Friday when I know the weekend is upcoming quickly. A last note on CLE for anyone seeking CLE credit. The attendance reporting form should now be in the chat box. Please open that and complete it immediately following this webinar. If you miss the link, it'll be emailed no later than Monday, July 27th. Your COA will be emailed to the address you provided when you registered for this webinar within a week, along with any pertinent CLE credit reporting information. If you don't receive any of that follow-up, please contact us at cle@fedsoc.org. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.